Case number 065278, Jim Lemon et al. Collins versus Pete Garrett, Secretary of Army et al. Mr. Edison for the appellants, Mr. Gates and Minister, Mr. Baldrick and appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Scott Edson of Melvin & Myers, and I represent the plaintiffs, Jim Lemon and Robin Visor. This is a classic procedural injury case in which the district court applied the wrong redressability standard. Specifically, the court required the plaintiffs to show that the procedural relief they seek, a supplemental environmental impact statement, will in fact produce a different result. That's the wrong standard, and the court should reverse. The plaintiffs here allege a classic procedural injury. They allege that the Secretary of the Army failed to produce a required supplemental environmental impact statement before approving a transfer of land that will impact the environmental quality of lands they use and enjoy. This is the same claim that the Supreme Court discussed in footnote 7 of Lujan, that challenging the failure to conduct an environmental impact statement before licensing a dam near the plaintiff's property. This is a classic procedural injury case. And because it's a classic procedural injury case, the redressability standard is relaxed. The very nature of a procedural injury is that you cannot show that more process will lead to a different result. And for that reason, the courts don't require plaintiffs to make that showing. Instead, a plaintiff has standing if he alleges the violation of a procedural requirement designed to protect his threatened concrete interest.
What's the purpose of an environmental impact statement in a base closing?
Your Honor,
the base has to be closed.
Yes, Your Honor, the base has to be closed, but that doesn't say what's going to happen to the future of the base. And so
that doesn't what?
That does not say what will happen to the future of the base. And so that does not dictate what will happen to the base and what the Army will do with it after it's closed. And it's to inform the Army about the environmental impacts of the range of things it could do with the base once it closes.
I thought it has to dispose of the property.
Yes, Your Honor, but it does have to dispose of the property, but the statute does not specifically mandate any form of disposal. It can do any number of things with the base. And even if it decides that it's going to transfer the property to another entity, as the Secretary decided to do in this case, there is a range of things that the government could do to restrict the downstream use of the property or to mitigate environmental impacts. It could prevent, for example, further development in a certain area. It could limit the amount of housing.
This is the encumbrances that they can put. They call it encumbrances they can put on the transfer.
Yes,
where does that? It wasn't clear where that came from. Is that a statutory, or by statute or regulation that the conveyance can include encumbrances?
Judge Randolph, I'm not familiar with any particular statute or regulation that says that it can do that. What the statute says is they have to dispose of it,
right.
But it doesn't say how. And so that gives them discretion to choose how to do it. It doesn't mandate any particular outcome. And so in reading the statute, it has to give the Secretary discretion as to how to do it, because it doesn't say you have to give it to this entity. It doesn't say you have to do that with it. It says dispose of the base. And so he has to reach some final resolution with the property, but it does not mandate any particular resolution. That's how that comes out, and so it gives.
And does it have to be conveyed to a government, a state or local government?
No, Your Honor, not in these circumstances. There are circumstances that are not at issue in this case in which the Secretary has to go through a process of considering other alternative uses by another federal agency or by other groups. But once it's made that determination, and we don't challenge that they've made those determinations in here, it requires that he dispose of the base, but it doesn't say how or to whom or in what when. It just says he has to dispose of the base. And that gives him the discretion to put encumbrances on it. He could keep it in caretaker status because that would be a final disposition of the base. There's a number of things they can do.
Suppose you're right in your standing argument. What happens next?
Judge Kavanaugh, what happens next is the case, since we've only been kicked out on standing, the case should go back to the district court for determination.
Right, and what happens there?
What happens there is we would have to proceed as any other case would. We haven't I guess there was a motion for summary judgment, but it hasn't been ruled on. It would go back. We could it would proceed as any other case would. I guess the district court would file a scheduling order.
What's the relief that you're ultimately seeking?
The relief that we're seeking in this case, Judge Kavanaugh, is we would like an injunction undoing the land transfer until the secretary takes the required consideration that Congress mandated and then evaluates his disposal alternatives in light of that.
How does the transfer have to be undone while that's occurring? That's what I'm pausing on.
You mean for the secretary to take further consideration?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that has to be undone because,
in other words, you could do the further consideration, and if at that point there were a reason to undo it, so be it. But why does it have to be undone while the further consideration's occurring?
Your Honor, I suppose that it's possible that it could happen in that way, but for it to work like that, the court would have to contain continual jurisdiction because the secretary is the one with the obligations under NEPA, and he has to do the consideration. And the way it works is it's not just a bunch of process that's supposed to happen to sort of figure out what's going to happen with this land. He's supposed to actually use that in his consideration of what to do with the land. So it has to be back in his possession so that he could decide whether or not, in light of a supplemental environmental impact statement, he should do something different. It has to be in his possession for him to do that.
There's no way to undo it after a further NEPA analysis if the secretary were to conclude, after considering all these environmental considerations, we actually don't want to do this any longer?
I'm not sure. There may be, but I think it might take a court order at that point because the secretary, again, the agency action is the giving of the land. And so, and it's his decision to give the land. So once he's given the land, he's got to have it back to decide whether or not he's going to do something with it. He wouldn't, I don't think, without a court stepping in, have the discretion to tell COPT, you have to go do something else. You have to go, it would have to sort of come back to the government for him to make that determination.
What else could he do with it, the land?
Your Honor, he could do any number of things with the land as long as it constitutes a disposal of the land. So he could put further restrictions on the land. He could decide that in light of these circumstances, we want to, for example, prohibit the ability to build on the parade grounds or limit the amount of building on the parade grounds or any number of other things. It's literally an open universe, and it's his discretion to make that determination at the end of the day. So that brings us back to the district court's decision dismissing this case because the plaintiffs cannot show that the procedural relief they seek will in fact produce a different result. Now, the defendants in their brief actually spend very little time discussing or defending the district court's decision on its own terms. Instead, they have several arguments that we've discussed, one of which is this idea that they have to dispose of the base in a given way. As I just discussed, the statute doesn't say that, the regulations don't say that, they just say it has to reach a disposal. They also say that because we subjectively want to stop the base closure, or we subjectively want to stop the redevelopment plan, that we are therefore alleging actually a substantive injury, not a procedural injury. There's no authority for that. Every procedural rights plaintiff has to, on some level, challenge the underlying agency action, or they will not be able to connect it to a concrete and particularized injury, as the Supreme Court required in Lujan.
When this case came up on the injunction pending appeal, I thought you suggested that it would be moot if the transfer occurred.
Your Honor, we said that it would be out of federal hands. That may have been the implication that we meant. That is incorrect if that's what we meant. Yes, Your Honor. It was incorrect if that's what we said, and that is not our position now. There's other reasons to enjoin it. We have other interests, but if that's what we meant, that is not our position now. And we think this district court, I don't know of any authority that would deprive a district court the authority to undo a completed land transaction that was challenged as unlawful.
It would have been helpful if that had been stated correctly then.
Yes, Your Honor. So this is, as I said, a classic procedural injury case in which the district court simply applied the wrong redressability standard. Unless the court has further questions, I'll come back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Alexander Hayes V. I represent the National Trust for Historic Preservation and amicus supporting the appellants in this case. On behalf of the National Trust, thank you for the opportunity to participate in this proceeding. Your Honors, the NHPA, the National Historic Preservation Act, confers standing in this case. The district court found otherwise, but erred by limiting its analysis to whether the appellants had a contractual right to enforce the terms of a programmatic agreement developed under Section 106 of the NHPA. And as a result, the court reached a decision that is inconsistent with a body of case law upholding the public's right to enforce the NHPA's procedural requirements under Article 3. The NHPA is strictly a procedural statute. Accordingly, the regulations implementing Section 106 of the Act provide interested members of the public with certain procedural rights, such as the right to be notified of federal actions affecting historic properties. The Section 106 regulations also authorize federal agencies to develop and implement alternative methods for complying with the Section 106 requirements. Programmatic agreements, such as the one at issue in this case, is one of those alternative methods. However, the procedural rights created by the regulations don't go away simply because the agency has elected to prepare a PA.
Is the National Trust, is that a, what they call in England, a quango, you know, a quasi-autonomous national government organization? What is the National Trust? Is it a corporation?
Correct. We were chartered by Congress in 1949. We are, however, a private.
It's like the Olympics or whatever, you know.
We are a nonprofit corporation.
Okay. Yeah. So we don't have the government arguing against the government.
That's correct.
Right.
That is correct, Your Honor. The procedural rights created by the regulations don't go away simply because the Army, in this case, has prepared a PA. In fact, the regulations specifically require that PAs afford the public the right to express their views to the agency concerning the adverse effects of historic properties, the adverse effects of the project on historic properties, and have the agency consider those objections through consultation with the interested members of the public. Here, the programmatic agreement complies with this requirement in Stipulation 13.
What are the limits on Stipulation 13? Not just any member of the public, right?
That's right. The limits on Stipulation 13 are contained in Article 3. And so the appellants in this case clearly have alleged that they've suffered an injury due to the Army's failure to consult with them over their objections and due to the relaxed standard.
Is it here it's primarily because of their proximity to Fort Ritchie? Is that it? Or?
According to the allegations, it's both their proximity, both of the appellants' own homes and use homes within 1 mile of the fort, and both of them use the...
If they live 10 miles, would that make a difference?
Well, that may make a difference. However, the appellants in this case do use the historic parade grounds within the fort, within Fort Ritchie for various recreational purposes as well. So even if they did live 10 miles away, they would still have suffered an injury in this case.
Is use of the property a requirement for standing?
I
mean, you're just saying that's...
That's what the plaintiffs have... That's what they've alleged in this case.
You're not saying that's a requirement.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, I'd have standing then.
Would you have standing?
Yeah, well, I'd have standing. Yeah, because I fished Antietam Creek, so, you know. And that runs through it, right?
It may. I'm not that familiar with the property myself.
Yeah.
So thus, the procedural rights at issue in this case aren't wholly contractual, as the district court found, but they're also statutory. And as numerous courts have previously held, the NHPA confers Article 3 standing on the public to enforce its requirements. So in conclusion, the district court's decision defeats the central purpose of the NHPA, and that is to facilitate public involvement in the preservation of historic properties, and this court should reverse. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, may it please the court, appellants saying this is a classic procedural injury case doesn't make it so. And I guess to figure out what does make it so, we need to look at this court's determinations. In National Parks, I think, the case at both sides cite is quite illuminative in this regard. And the reason is what National Parks says at page 5 is in a classic procedural case, the same person is responsible for the procedural defect as the injury of the final action. And so that link, that attenuation, is what creates issues. And one of the issues in National Parks was the people weren't the exact same. In other words, there's a DOI, the issue of whether or not they played a role in the ultimate action, which was the permit that was granted by the state of Montana. And it was that link that needed to be addressed. Similarly, in that case, the issue was challenged because in that situation, there was an issue with withdrawing the letter after the letter was done without consulting it. So much like in this case, there was a substantive action that had taken place. In other words, appellants in this case don't like the EIS. They don't like the result that came out that said the plan, the COPS plan that's been the last plan fit within that EIS. So they're basically trying to challenge that substantively. Now, they're doing that well pleaded in a way that says, no, what we'd like is a second EIS. But essentially what they're trying to do is challenge the substantive determination that
was
made.
That's true in every single case, NEPA case, that I have ever seen for 30 years.
Your Honor, the difference in many of those cases, at least the one cited, is that there was no EIS done. And that's why the district...
No, you know, take... you know, I argued a case in the Supreme Court in 1975, I guess it was called, Kleppe versus Sierra Club. And there was a huge impact statement done. It just wasn't sufficient, according to the Sierra Club. You know, and the reason was because they wanted to stop surface coal mining in Wyoming. You know, so I don't understand the point of all that.
Your Honor, if I can retreat back to my first point then, I guess, and the issue of the attenuation, in other words, the link between the agency action, in other words, the government action, and the party that is the harm where it's alleged to occur, because that causation link is an essential link, whether you're looking
at... Where's the attenuation here?
Your Honor, there's significant attenuation here, and I guess the way I would like to kind of draw it out is almost in a syllogism with national parks, is if you look at it, in other words, they're alleging our failure to do an EIS has some type of effect on COP's redevelopment plan. But the truth is COP's redevelopment plan is not dictated by the Army. It's not like the case in national parks where you're approving a permit or many other NEPA or NEPA actions where you're approving anything.
But they also claim, without contradiction, that the Secretary had the authority to place encumbrances upon the transfer. Now, I take it that means that, you know, no redevelopment in this place, no redevelopment in that place, you know, leave this parade ground, you know, the way it was. And these are the, you know, the restrictive covenants, I guess is the word that one uses on the transfer. So if that's the case, why haven't they...
I would say that they don't have that authority, and it's not clear. Do they have the ability to transfer the property with encumbrance? The answer is yes, that's what they've done. That's a way for transferring property. But there's nothing that kind of indicates how they should do that, and specifically there's contrary authority. In other words, the Base Closure Realignment Act, unlike other areas, says you must give substantial deference to the redevelopment plans that are submitted by the state agency, by Penmar here. So this is not a case, unlike when you're permitting for something or where you're approving something, where you're supposed to take and analyze that plan and tell them you can do this and you can't do that.
I just want to be clear. The government in transferring can place restrictive covenants on the land. You know, you can't develop here. You can't do, the government can do that, right?
The government... did transfer this property with encumbrances, so I would concede
that. Okay, so
it has to
be able to do that.
The level of encumbrances that they could do, I think, is an unclear question. In other words, what they did in these encumbrances, as you see, kind of laid out.
So you do a supplemental environmental impact statement, and one always hopes that the decision maker reads it, which is, by the way, not always the case. But it's done, and the decision maker looks at it and says, "Oh my goodness, you know, I'm going to reconsider. I want to put a restrictive covenant on this area that runs by Antietam Creek, because if we get a lot of pollution in there, Randolph can't fish there anymore, right?"
And what I would say in this type of case, where unlike other NEPA actions or agencies that you see, they were directed not to do that. In other words, to give substantial deference to the plan, whatever it may be, of the other side. So I think that would be an inappropriate. So we're talking about a very narrow band of issues here. In other words, what they've done.
Well, they give deference, but that doesn't mean that they're totally, you know, that they have to agree with everything, do they?
Your Honor, I agree it's not a blank check, but I think that gives us some context of where we are here. In other words, they did this EIS. They looked at the plan. They looked at the general category of the plan as a medium reuse alternative.
That's all merits.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why it gets difficult to talk about this. But in other words, that is merits, and that's why I think this is not clearly as much because it's not the same party affecting the action.
If you're arguing merits, why shouldn't the district court do that in the first instance?
Your Honor, I'm not arguing the merits. I'm showing that their attempt to challenge the merits is one of the reasons that the procedural versus substantive injury question becomes more difficult. But what I did want to do is to give the court some context, because you're asking
I don't understand why the procedural substantive dichotomy even matters in this case. Why does it matter? Look, these people are adjacent property owners, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and Would you agree that if the plan was that they're that the local authorities are going to erect 15-story skyscrapers on what had been a pristine piece of property, that they could claim the injury from that?
Your Honor, I would say no, because the government is not in charge of what
they're
doing.
And the Army, knowing that, does not put any conditions on it?
Your Honor, I would say the most the Army can do is kind of in what the EIS has done for in the base closure process, as opposed to in the approving of a permit process or something else, is kind of highlight these issues to the state and local redevelopment authorities.
See, maybe the Army can't do anything about it. Maybe it can. Maybe it should take it into account. Maybe it shouldn't. But the fact of the matter is that if I'm sitting in a house and I'm looking out over a beautiful piece of property, and I know that because of major federal action, I'm now going to look over, you know, a whole series of skyscrapers, I'm injured. Now, maybe I'm not going to be able to do anything about it on the merits, but at least I can bring a complaint and say, hey, judge, do something about this. And the judge says, well, you know, you don't have a cause of action, but you have standing.
Your Honor, I would say it's a different challenge. In other words, the Army disposing of the property isn't what builds your skyscraper. And that's kind of my issue, is you have plenty of means to challenge within the parameters of who's building that building. In other words, what COP does to the redevelopment plan,
I know,
both the
but
one
that
approved.
Gets you, then you have the problem of encumbrances, because the property owner, you go to the Secretary of the Army and say, hey, look, you know, please leave this space open. Okay, I'll do that. And, you know, I transfer the property on condition that space is left open.
But that would be contrary to the clear legislative intent of Congress, which said in the base closure process you should give substantial deference to their plan. So that type of tweaking of a NEPA action, the thing that you would be asking government to do, is absolutely contrary to what we would want to have there. And the substantial deference is what we're trying to say here. This means that the Army will not do that and will not second-guess the decisions of both the state of Maryland, who is Penmar, and then what they choose to do with the property. So we're two steps removed from that. And that's why I think it's important to put this EIS in context of perhaps your experience and the experience of other EISs.
Is the transfer done before the Army or before the government, whatever, it could be the Navy, it knows about the what the plans are for the use of the property?
Your Honor, I think, like most redevelopment plans, is they are changing. It's not a static thing. It's changing now. So the answer was they received one plan. The initial plan from Penmar, they evaluated that plan. Then they received a second subsequent plan from the COP, once Penmar adopted COP's plan, and that is a new plan. That is the one that appellants challenged.
Is there a negotiation between the government and the local authorities about what the plan is?
Your Honor, my understanding is absolutely not, and that's the point. The Army doesn't play any role in determining what should happen on that property. All we do is we take the plan that the local authority gives to us, and we put it in to try to, again, highlight these environmental recommendations. So it's very different than the case that you point out, where the Army is actively trying to do that, put the highway here, put the building here. They don't play any such role in this process.
What about when the government licenses a nuclear reactor and the people next door want to sue?
Your Honor, I think National Parks is a similar situation to that, and that is a great example, because in that case, I think what you saw is, as de facto matter, what DOI did controlled what the state does. In other words, they said, hey, because what the Department of Interior actually does has a very significant and logical effect on whether or not this power plant will be built, or in that case, a coal plant will be built, therefore it's related and it's relevant. Importantly, they also looked at redressability in national parks, though, in which you would at least do relaxed if it was a procedural standing case. And what they said is, in that case, the permit issue was still open. The state of Montana had, in fact, told the state court had told the state of Montana to go back and relook and see if it made sense to go ahead and build this plant and whether the Department of Interior's letter was appropriate. So again, they said there was a legal relationship between DOI and the state, and it actually had a de facto control over whether or not the permit would be made. And that strong nexus was much different from here, where what the Army says is basically, I won't say irrelevant because it's too strong, but it is too attenuated to properly make a difference in the
appellant's case. Can you square your argument with footnote 7 of Lujan?
Yes, Your Honor, I think we can. And again, the difference between footnote 7 is, again, it's the same party who's creating the action as the harm, and that's the difference here. In other words, you have to look at not just...
Isn't the harm created in footnote 7 hypothetical, the operator of the dam?
Your Honor, it's presumed that the federal government would be creating the harm in that instance, and that's the difference here. The federal government isn't the one creating that harm. If the federal government was building this high-rise, we'd be right square within...
Where the federal government licenses a private operator, private operator could then cause the harm.
But the federal government is licensing. They're actually doing something that is, again, much stronger than what we're doing here.
It's kind of like Overton Park. You familiar with that case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. The Secretary of Transportation approved federal aid highway funds for a highway that go right smack through Overton Park, and I think it was Tennessee. And so that it resulted in a very famous Supreme Court case. But nobody questioned that the plaintiffs in that case were Citizens to Preserve Overton Park. That's the name of the case, right?
Yes,
and because they liked the park. They had standing, right? Even though it wasn't the Secretary of Transportation that was going to be building the highway, it was an aid to highways with federal funds.
But, Your Honor, they had substantial control, so that, I mean, it is much different. In other words, they were funding the road. They were approving it, much like permitting it. When the federal government's doing something to affirmatively cause this, they gave all the money that built the road.
So your argument turns entirely on the phrase substantial deference that you keep invoking. Without substantial deference, would you be arguing differently?
It certainly is a strong part of the argument, Your Honor. The second part is, again, I think there's this redressability issue, and there's some real limitations on that. In other words,
it seems to me you're suggesting that the language of substantial deference means the government, the Army, has no responsibility here. That they simply have nothing to do with what's going to happen on Fort Ritchie, and that's just not the case, right?
Your Honor, I think it is the case that their responsibility was to, unlike permitting or funding or licensing,
it's different responsibility, but they have some responsibility, right? As you said, it's not blank check.
The responsibility is to get rid of the property and do it in a responsible manner. I mean, that is
responsible manner.
Yes,
and a responsible,
sir,
manner may be affected by an environmental impact statement, right? That could change what they're going to do.
Yes, Your Honor, it can change. Yes, Your Honor.
Do you know what happened in Overton Park? You know, after the Supreme Court said to the Secretary of Transportation, we don't have a reasoned decision from you, and sent the case back for reconsideration. Do you know what happened?
No, Your Honor.
The highway was never built through Overton Park.
Mm-hmm.
The Secretary changed his mind after he reconsidered.
Your Honor, and that in some ways is very helpful for my case, because this isn't a case where we can come back as much as the Army shorts personnel right now and reopen Fort Ritchie and add folks to that base. This base must be closed and it must be transferred. And that's the only federal action that we're looking at here. We're not talking about the government actually doing something in that way, which is, again, a significant difference. I would also point, I guess, to bring the argument full circle, is to the mootness issue, which I think is equally important and compelling here because of those very facts. In other words, when you look at the redressability prong, which is an important prong of standing, especially even under procedural, it's relaxed, but still there, there's
Isn't there some chance that if an environmental, a supplemental environmental impact statement were conducted, that the decision might end up different here? Isn't there some chance of that?
Your Honor, what I would say is, conceding that there may be some chance, it certainly isn't the substantial probability, which is a requirement for procedural standing. So you're nowhere close to the standing requirements. There's always some chance, Your Honor. But the idea that plaintiffs can establish standing by saying there's some chance that the Army does something, the outcome will make a difference. That's what attenuation is all about, and drawing that line is difficult. And here, unlike I think every other case you will look at, especially Overton Park and anything else you pull up, there's a much bigger role for the federal government than we're talking about here. And that attenuation is so great when the Army plays no role in the redevelopment that I would say that the attenuation is too strong. And obviously that's a fluid concept, and that's for Your Honors to decide, but I think that is a valid consideration that needs to be addressed.
On the mootness, we'd be creating a circuit split with the Ninth and Tenth Circuits, wouldn't we?
Yes, Your Honor, you would absolutely be doing that. And again, I think I'm aware of no circumstances where a situation like this, where there was an injunction and the injunction was relieved and a request for a stay was issued with the court, and then the court came back and undid a title transfer. And additionally, some of the cases like Industrial Park that
appellants... Say we'd create a circuit split if we agreed with your position.
Between the Ninth Circuit, Your Honor?
With the Ninth and Tenth Circuits.
Your Honor, I don't think necessarily, because, again, there's some differences between those cases. Those cases did not involve an actual stay. In fact, they didn't even request a stay pending appeal. So that's a significant difference.
How does that affect the mootness?
Your Honor, it affects certainly the prudential doctrine of mootness. In other words, if the idea is a court wants to reserve its power to hear a case. And they do that, and that's the idea behind all those cases, is you don't want someone to go out and do something that kind of then go to the court and say, ha, now you can't touch us. And that is the concern in all those cases running through it, usually. And you can see the general rule in this circuit and in other circuits is that, you know, once you've done that, you don't undo the transaction. And I guess, again, unfortunately, due to the limited time of the briefing, these issues weren't fully briefed. But, for example, in the Fifth Circuit, in the case of Harris versus City of Houston, 151 Fed 3rd, Fifth Circuit, 1998, they exactly did the opposite thing. In other words, appellants came and said, why don't you undo that transfer of land? And this was a case where the City of Houston had annexed a part of a property to be part of their voting group. They annexed a little section of the area, brought it within the City of Houston.
When did they bring the suit?
They brought the suit in that case prior to the annexation, I believe. And then what happened was when they challenged it, they said, can you undo it? And I need to be clear, I'm not positive when they brought the suit. But the issue was, you know, can't you just simply undo it? And they cited to those Ninth Circuit cases as well, saying, yeah, you should go ahead and undo it. And the Fifth Circuit said, no, you can't do that. The general rule is, and they cited the D.C. Circuit for the proposition, they cited the City of Houston versus HUD, 24 F3rd 1424, for the proposition that a court has the power under equity to hold something and to make sure they have the ability to hear it. But generally speaking, the rule is, once the action sought to be enjoined, it goes forward, that power's gone. And so now whether or not there's a legal power to do it or not, I think is an open question, especially with issues of whether or not Penmar and COPT would be proper parties on remand when it's only a federal action case. Again, there's other circuits that say you can't enjoin a non-federal actor from doing anything in a purely NEPA or an HBA case. And there's some concerns about that. Again, the Fifth Circuit, again, is instructive. If you look at 875 Fed Second 453 in the...
Have you given these cases to your opponents?
Your Honor, we haven't, and that's one of the issues, unfortunately, with the kind of late suggestion of mootness issue.
Yeah, okay. Well, you're way over your time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I just want to reiterate, we're here on standing. So whether or not the district court may someday decide to exercise its equitable jurisdiction to do one thing or another says nothing about the authority of the district court to do so when it has all the parties in front of it. In 1946, the Supreme Court said that authority had long been established. This wouldn't just create a circuit split. It would be contrary to Supreme Court law. Another point I'd like to make is...
Could you address the interplay between the substantial probability standard and the substantial deference standard?
Yes, Your Honor. As I understand their argument, and I have to admit I'm having some difficulty with it, they are confusing the substantial probability standard that is required to show between the agency action and the ultimate injury with the inquiry as to between the causal nexus between the procedural breach and the agency action. And this court has been clear, and the Supreme Court has been clear, that the relaxed redressability standard gets you over the causal nexus between the procedural breach and the agency action. So we don't have to get into what percentage of times agencies reverse themselves. We assume that more process could lead to a different result, and that's enough. With respect to their substantial deference points, I think it's exceedingly telling that they will concede that they have the power to do something different with the land if they want to. I think it's important to understand that the nature of their...
Let me back up. I'm sorry. What you just said didn't seem to square with my memory. I'm reading from Florida Audubon Society right now.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which says the plaintiff must show, quote, plaintiff must show that it is substantially probable that the procedural breach will cause the essential injury to the plaintiff's own interests. So.
Yes, Your Honor. And what this court said in National Parks is there's really two links to the chain. And what it's talking about in Benson is the second link in the chain. That's the National Parks Conservation Association decision, that the relaxed redressability standard that's discussed in Lujan footnote 7 takes care of the first link, because we don't want to get into how important is or how likely is it that this procedure will change the result. We assume that if it's designed for this purpose, it will do that. So it's the second link, I think, is what he's taking the standard for the second link and grafting it back for the first. At the time we filed suit, Penmar had an agreement signed with COPT, and Penmar had actually, their board had approved the COPT plan. There was no question that once they gave the land over, it would go. We have a substantial probability in this case. to circle back to his substantial deference argument, once they concede, their argument on this point, as I understand it, is in the nature of a jurisdictional argument, which is to say that he has no authority, and they actually say that at page 21 of their brief, he has no authority to do anything different with the land. But he concedes that he has some authority, and once he does that, he gives that up. And in fact, if you'll turn to page 1002 of the joint appendix, there's a provision in the agreement between the Army and Penmar, which specifically says that the use of the property by PMDC, that's Penmar, shall be in general accord with the reuse plan, which was the 1997 plan that was on the table at the time. So they actually put that in the contract they signed with Penmar. I guess I would just come back to the fact that this is a classic procedural injury case in which the district court applied the wrong redressability standard, and this court should reverse.